I am joined in the Hudson studio right now by Peter Wheelwright. Peter is an architect and an associate professor at Parsons, the New School for Design, at the New School University in New York City. He's also the designer behind the Kaleidoscope House, a modernist dollhouse designed in collaboration with artist Laurie Simmons that you might have seen at the Museum of Modern Art. And he's now the author of a novel called As It Is on Earth, published in September. The novel, which I have almost finished, but not quite, so I've warned Peter there's no spoiler alerts allowed, is set in New England over 7 days at the end of the millennium, 1999. It follows a young professor from a family of Maine Puritans trying to come to terms with his family's history and religious legacy. How was that, Peter? Was that okay?
That was very good, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Perhaps
Peter,
it's good that you didn't finish the book. You might not have invited me.
Uh-oh. Is it that kind of ending?
Well, you'll see.
I forgot to mention that you're also a resident here of Columbia County, which is part of the reason why we're so excited to have you here on the radio.
Happy to be here, yeah.
Well, so I'm wondering if you can just situate us a little bit. I just gave that very general plot summary, but especially because the novel does have sort of a distinct structure to it. Can you just sort of ground us in the book?
Well, the story takes place over 8 days leading up to Columbus Day at the end of the millennium in 1999. As you mentioned, it's narrated by a character called Taylor Thatcher, who's a troubled young college professor from Maine who's badly bogged down in his New England past. The structure of the book, I think, is important to sort of lay out. I'm going to do a little reading, I gather, in a few moments, but I just wanted to explain that the book is laid out in eight chapters, chapter 0 through 7. And they're loosely based on the 7 days of Genesis, plus, or I should say, to begin with, the day before. As the narrator said, in the beginning was the Word, but what about before that? So each chapter is one of those 8 days.
Well, I do want to ask you more about that, but I think maybe for listeners who haven't encountered the book yet, maybe starting with a reading would be sort of nice, and then we can dig in a little bit.
Okay. I'm going to read a short bit from the chapter zero. It introduces the narrator's brother and the Cajun Passamaquoddy woman who raised him and his father. Mount Vernon, Maine, first days. I had just turned 3 when the proud and wounded young woman from Simsport, Louisiana, came to live with us 27 years ago. Bingham was still dangling a scabbed umbilical cord. My father, widowed for a second time, was a country physician with a small community to watch over. Esther Flournoy Bishop was assigned to oversee Bingham and me. In this, Esther's eyes were an advantage. She told us early on that she had a glass eye, but for a long time we were never quite sure which was which. Guess, she'd say. Once when my grandparents, the Careys, Steamer and Moody, came up from Mamakoke, I had to sleep in Esther's room. I was still quite young and not happy about sharing a bed with her. The sheets had that strange, familiar smell of unsolicited intimacy, the lived-in smell of someone else's home. I was glad that she slept facing away. She was not big, but she was filled out and shaped in ways I did not like thinking about, not on her. Fighting the edge of the bed to stay clear of her presenting bottom, I watched the moonlight on the back of her nightgown until I fell asleep. At some point during the night, she rolled over, and I awoke, eyeball to eyeball with that glistening marble of hers. She was sound asleep, but I was as alert as an owl's prey until the sun came up. Even with that bad eye, Esther was pretty in a kind of inattentive way. Every morning, right out of bed, when most people appear disheveled and dream-swollen, she came fresh to the downstairs kitchen. She saw a little point in makeup and would cut her own hair just to avoid the fuss. Coffee grounds dark, falling straight and easy from a middle part to the shoulders. It framed her lopsided and piercing look like a finely crafted oval mirror. Tucking loose strands behind the ear that was cocked our way, she'd have one eye scanning a frying pan while freezing us at the breakfast table with the other. It was hard for me to know when to make a move. "I can see everything that needs seeing," she'd warn. I learned her blind side soon enough. It was the dimple. She had only one, formed from a small chevron scar that pointed to the lost eye. It tucked deep into her cheek when she smiled. Ben and I leaned up to it like saplings to the sun. My father was slowly drawn to her as well, although I believe he was only comparing scars. The unexpected love they later shared was a desperate one. Despite her slight bayou twang, Esther found herself right back home in Maine. The details could change with each telling, but she claimed to be the descendant of a French trapper from Casco Bay, who had been part of the Acadian diaspora during the French and Indian Wars. Dragged away from his Algonquin Passamaquoddy wife and daughters in the dead of winter, La Jeunesse Fleur Noire had been placed on board a British frigate along with his two sons and some other hapless Normandy man, where they were scattered to the North American winds. Like lost milkweed seeds floating off course on their snowy tendrils, La Jeunesse and his boys landed in steamy Louisiana, germinated, and produced the first passel of Jesuit Cajuns that still crop up today. Esther said he was never happy away from his home up north and drowned one Christmas Eve at the frozen border of Maine while trying to cross the Piscataqua River. That particular detail in the story was memorable and for years haunted me each December on the ice of Walled In as I tried to get into the spirit of the season. But I think Esther was just trying to make a point about the importance of family. Ours, that is. Her own family life had followed the broken trail of La Jeunesse. Lucky for us, she made it across the Piscataqua. Our farm in Mount Vernon, Maine, wasn't a real farm. My father only called it one because we had land and were surrounded by farmers. 200 acres of thick, shaly fields, seasonal streams, and white pine forest. Our less arable property pushed apart the corners of three working farms, the result of Abenaki land clearing, colonial border disputes, and bad surveying. My father had figured it both ways. He preferred his land as it was now, untouched and wild, only growing things seeded by breeze and God's winged creatures. On the other hand, by association with his neighbors, he felt a farmer, with all the honorable virtues that came with working the land. The fact that he was commuting every other day 23 miles overland to the hospital in Augusta was incidental. He made his living in Augusta, but the patients he cared for most were in Mount Vernon. In the spring, when the newly thawed fields were swollen and stirring, he'd call Ben and me out to the front porch and have us stand quietly with eyes closed, just to listen and smell our fine agrarian life. The distant moans of McMoody's cows wafting in on the same breeze as the musty manure from Bog Danfy's chicken farm and pierced by the intermittent clang of Renault Thibodeau stubbornly readying another piece of overworked farm equipment for the season. It was during these times that my father looked content to me, not particularly joyful, but at least peaceful. Sneaking a one-eyed peek at him, I used to hope there was still a chance that he might burst forth in new life, just like his land. But as much as he loved his place on earth, he was already preparing for the life thereafter. My father's hair had turned early, long before I was able to recognize how misfortune makes its marks. Esther would usually cut it for him after tending to her own, and he would wear it with a part high up on the side of his head, like I'd seen in old photographs of his father. Only the thinnest remains of black streaked through the smooth white hair when Esther ran a wet comb through it. It made him look dashing in an old-fashioned way. Tall, straight-spined, with wide shoulders always held back, and a determined jaw like an icebreaker, my father, despite everything, cut an impressive figure right up to the end. But it was difficult to look him in the eyes. Unlike Esther, he could see just fine, never needed glasses and prided himself on it. But I knew, like her, he had seen bad things. It was mostly out of childish fear that I avoided meeting his glance, and maybe some awe as well. They were not unkind, his eyes. I just never felt they provided me with much of an opening. Esther said that most men's gaze stops at the horizon, but our father could see right around the curve of the earth. That didn't make me feel much better.
If you're just tuning in, that was Peter Wheelwright reading from his recently published novel, As It Is on Earth. And I'm actually really glad, I hadn't even thought about this, but I'm really glad that you chose to read that excerpt, which is from the very beginning of the book. But it just struck me as sort of an interesting metaphor, the Esther's vision and her bad eye, but her real gaze. And the idea that she can see everything that needs seeing. I was just thinking about the description of the book that you gave, that it takes place over the course of 8 days, but that its vision extends much deeper into history than that, and that it takes us far beyond the farm in Mount Vernon, but all over. And not only into the history of the Thatcher family, but natural and geological histories, religious histories. There's a lot of different histories interwoven in this. And I'm particularly interested in how you've woven together indigenous history and then some of the more Yankee or colonial history of this family, which is something that the characters wrestle with throughout the book. Could you talk a little bit about some of the woven histories in the book?
Sure. I mean, you're right. The story is situated in New England, but it but people say, oh well, this is a New England story. It's kind of a parochial tale you're telling. I don't feel that it is. That just happens to be the locale where this larger story about how we're all products of events and places and people in historical time.
Taylor calls himself a casualty of history.
Yes, he's definitely a casualty. he's lost his sense of self. He's just sort of come to the realization in his somewhat confused state of mind that he has no self, that he's just the product of other events, other places, other gods. I think he calls himself a hammered pinball with historical levers and plungers kicking him around.
And tolling bells. Tolling
bells, right. So he sees that any idea of a kind of autonomous self is an illusion, that he's really just been, he finds himself where he is and who he is as a function of things that were beyond his control. And it's not just sort of social histories, but as you say, it's also sort of geological histories. I mean, there's this big sort of distinction he keeps making in the book about the difference between the earth and the world, the earth as a real deep time entity that precedes humanity, and the world is what humanity makes of the earth when it shows up on it. And so his sense of deep time is also part of that historical perspective that he carries. In terms of the indigenous, I assume you mean the indigenous tribes in New England and the New England story. There's a wonderful book that was written by William Cronin, an environmental historian, years ago called Changes in the Land. And it was very important because it basically made the point that you cannot speak about American colonial history in the age of discovery without deeply weaving into it the indigenous life and experience and the encounter and the sort of mutual assimilation for better and worse, you know, degrees between the two. So I think Taylor Thatcher, the narrator, really appreciates that as well.
I was trying to imagine all of the different sections of a library that you might have had to spend time in writing this book, and thinking of the list of like different historic threads that kind of find themselves in the book, and what kind of research could have gone into it. I was thinking about what library sections you might have been camped out in.
Right, books of the dead. Well, you know, it's interesting. There were ideas, there were themes in this book that I was very interested in developing through a kind of fictional storytelling. And this, I suppose, is the academic in me. I sort of joke to others, if you sat in one of my seminars at the New School, you would be, you know, this book would seem very familiar to you. So I don't, you know, it wasn't researched in the sense of I'm now sitting down to research this novel I'm going to write. It was kind of the culmination of a lot of interests and ideas and issues that I've been thinking about for really quite a number of years.
Taylor Thatcher, who's the book's protagonist, his academic work is kind of like goofily multidisciplinary. Right. I think there was a course that he teaches that like freezes the university database because it's has such a long title.
Right, right.
I can't remember the name of it.
It packs together, the title of his course packs together every single discipline you could have a major in if you were a college student.
But you might be able to describe the book the same way, that there's philosophy thread. There's a lot of science and natural history. There's also all of the different histories we've talked about. There's cosmology. Yeah. And in some ways, maybe it's less about any one of those things and more about the kind of connectivity.
Well, I'm definitely playing off this idea of discipline in two senses of the word. One, this kind of this kind of involvement these days in interdisciplinary thought, and I mean, this is all we talk about in the universities these days. This is sort of like the thing to be doing. So I'm sort of riffing off of those, poking a little bit of fun at that, but also the idea of discipline with a capital D in the sort of Calvinist, St. Augustine idea. And the narrator, while teaching all these multidisciplinary courses, is also viewed by his father as being very undisciplined, that he's a hard case. His dean at the university also considers him undisciplined, and he makes the point to his dean, well, isn't that the whole point, to be undisciplined?
Will you tell me a little bit about guilt in the book?
Guilt. Well, there is a little bit of the Cain and Abel story here in the relationship of the two brothers, the narrator and his kind of loony younger brother Bingham.
Bingham is my favorite character.
Yeah, Bingham. Everybody loves Bingham.
Really?
How can you not love Bingham? He's a man of the earth. I mean, he's, and that's the thing, is they're sort of juxtaposed. One is very imminent in the immanent sense, and the other is a sort of transcendent. You know, he's got his head in the clouds, and the other is very grounded. I think the narrator makes light of Bin's college degree, which was in pre-human studies, and he doesn't know quite what that means, but it's characteristic of Bin. So there is a little bit of that Cain and Abel, although, as the narrator says, sort of midway in the book to his growing love interest, Miriam Bloom, he really wonders whether actually it's about the third brother, Seth, the one we know little about in our biblical training. We're taught that we know a lot about the Cain and Abel story, but Seth is the guy who shows up after, of course, Cain kills Abel, and Adam and Eve have another son, and he is the one to replace the lost son. So he's clearly the narrative. Thing had happened. This is the spoiler alert part. there was an event that happened between the boys when they were very young, and much of the narrator's sense of a lost self has to do with that event, and he's trying to put it all back together, which he does. I can say that much. He does, in a manner of speaking.
Part of the reason I was asking about guilt was interested in both the sort of that relationship, the relationship between the two brothers, and the ways in which Taylor is sort of wrestling with that relationship, and then also this, because we were just talking about the sort of broader historical sweeps, the sort of like early on he's thinking about like, you know, like don't blame me for what my family has done, and
right.
and exploring the roots of his Mayflower family and their and their role in New England, and kind of understanding his role as a part of that history.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, he definitely, you know, he's very attuned to his WASPy background, and you know, he feels targeted for that, and as he says, you know, he feels everybody beats him over the head on that score, including the women faculty at his school. And he just wants to lower his head and put his hands up and walk away with a little theater and say, hey, I'm just one of you guys. I'm just, you know, trying to get on. So he's, yeah, I mean, that's part of what he's trying to dislodge himself from, that sense of having been the victim of the, you know, the plunderings and pillaging of his Puritan ancestors.
And that was actually a piece that I found myself surprised by in as I've been reading the book, is in the ways in which it feels like a really thoughtful meditation on the role of the kind of family that the Thatchers are in this place. And I bet you get this question everywhere, but I was so curious about your family history, in what ways this is autobiographical, semi-autobiographical, what, I have no idea.
Well, you know, it's not autobiographical, but as I've said in other interviews, you know, we write what we know, and I know this kind of territory well. That there's a
you calling yourself a WASP?
Wheelwright, the makers of wheels from medieval England. Yeah, we're that's true. But there's a character in there when Taylor Thatcher is talking about the settling of Maine. He refers to this apostatic minister from the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and he leads this band of heretical characters out. They get exiled, and they go up and found what ultimately becomes the state of Maine. That actually is a reference to the Reverend John Wheelwright, who is my 13th generation's back down the line or up the line ancestor. He was Anne Hutchinson's brother-in-law. Anne Hutchinson, the more famous one to have been expelled in that event, the so-called antinomian crisis in Boston. So yes, I'm drawing on the Reverend John, Grandpa John Wheelwright.
You know, that question, well, both the sort of like trying to understand, imagining in my own head some of the symmetry maybe in this book and in your own and in your own life and inventing all kinds of things.
Yeah.
But then also starting to map out some of the sort of broad connectivity that's happening throughout the book. That's actually, it's quite complicated, and there's a lot of threads that are coming together, and it's part of what makes it such a kind of a thorough read. And and I've known you forever as an architect, and as a professor in design. And I was imagining this, the book visually a lot, and I wonder wonder how many readers are doing that when they knowing your own professional and academic background. And I was curious about how you think about the architecture of the book.
Well, you know, it's my colleagues, my architecture pals, shake their heads and roll their eyes and reel back and say, wow, I could no more write a novel than fly to the moon. I'm so impressed that you did this. And to me, our training as architects, it couldn't prepare one better for writing a novel. And I've talked about this elsewhere. I mean, all of the, architects are storytellers for a start. You know, architects tell stories about their buildings. They tell stories about the landscape that they're putting their buildings on or into. And they tell stories about cities. And they have to tell stories in order to get people interested in having them actually design something. So there's that aspect, but there's also then this business of sitting quietly, and you've got a pencil in your hand, or you're at a laptop, or you're trying to kind of fabricate something. You're trying to design it, and all the sort of spatial tropes that we use as architects apply to writing a book. You know, how am I going to get into it? You know, how will I move through it? What will its structure be? Where are the places where it's going to get spatially compressed and dense, and where will it expand in a sort of lyrical, playful, decorative, ornamental way? You know, all these kinds of things are very transferable from architecture to writing fiction. So for me, it felt like what I always do anyway. I'm just doing it in a different kind of output way.
For people who are just tuning in, this is the WGXC Afternoon Show. We've got Peter Wheelwright here in the WGXC Hudson studio talking about his new and first novel called As It Is on Earth. I have to say, hearing you answer that question, I wish more architects cared so deeply about the history of the places that they're working in, and kind of like complex entanglements that places embody.
And you're not the first one to say that. Susan Snazzi, who is the editor of Metropolis magazine, very well-regarded design magazine, said the same thing to me at a recent panel. And I hope I'm imparting some of this to the architecture students that I teach. I teach graduate architecture students. I feel this connectivity deeply. I feel the importance of really understanding a larger picture than just the kind of, you know, myopic view onto, well, I'm going to do this one little building and, you know, there's nothing outside of it. Maybe I too need to recover myself. So
in the narrative arc of this conversation, we have just done a full circle back to Esther's eye, and the gaze.
The gaze. Eh? Yeah.
We only have a few more minutes, and I want to make sure we have we talk about where this book exists out in the world, where people might be able to find you, or where people might be able to find the book. I didn't make it to a panel that you were on at Spencer in Spencertown a couple weeks ago, and I only caught a sort of a glimpse of that conversation. But I know that your publisher is sort of experimenting with publishing and what's happening to books now. And I was wondering, I don't understand. So can you tell me? Both, that's a two-part question, both how people can find this book, and then also maybe if you could talk a little bit about how the book is being printed.
Well, the Fomite Press is the publisher, I sort of feel like I have to give the backstory on all this, because I had written this book, and And then did what I think most people do in New York, or probably everywhere. I sent it out to sort of a dozen of the top agents in New York, and got back what I thought was very, very encouraging, initially very, very encouraging responses, a lot of sort of pats on the head, but little concern that wasn't commercially viable. And, you know, one even said, well, you know, we need a little more, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll right off the bat. You know, you're taking him in.
It's too Puritan.
Sort of, yeah, right. And then I actually sent the first 50 some pages to my uncle, the author Peter Matheson,
right,
who, with great surprise to me and obviously great pleasure, thought it was really wonderful and asked if he could send it to his agent. Anyway, so that happened, and I got the same thing back from his agent. A lot of sort of, this is great. But, you know, I just would have a very hard time selling it. It's not a commercial book. It's literary fiction, and they're the hardest thing in the world right now to sell. So I said, well, look, I have three options. I can either put this book away, pat myself on the head, and start another one. I can rewrite it, or I can keep going. And he said, don't rewrite it. This is your book. This is the book. This is a good book. Don't put it away. Keep going. Go to an independent press. And within a week of doing that, I got two hits in two independent presses who wanted to pick up the book. Mm. And I went with the FOMI Press because the editor, Mark Estrin, I thought really understood the book incredibly well. But they are a very small outfit. They're up in Burlington, Vermont. They have very thoughtful books. I mean, as I think they say on their website, about the human condition. You know, of course, everything's about the human condition, but they really mean it. they don't have a big PR staff. They do print on demand, so the book is. And you can get it anywhere, at any bookstore, and of course Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all the online venues have it right away. But it's a new technology, which is sort of, you know, I know very little about the publishing world, but this idea of print-on-demand is kind of interesting because it allows me, when I get a new review, for example, somebody reviews, like the Tottenville Review is doing a review this week, I'll be able to upload that into the book. Hmm. If anybody picks up anything wrong in the book, I can correct them. My brother wrote me recently, said my Spanish is terrible in a couple of spots, so I could correct those. So it's an interesting thing. I mean, the downside of it is the bookstores won't carry it unless there's people ask for it.
Right.
Because with print on demand, they can't necessarily return the books if they don't sell. So they've got to feel like the book has got some legs before they're going to invest in it.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that Derek Furr was in here recently, who's another author represented by the FOMI Press. And I haven't met Derek, but it'll be interesting to hear his experience with the local bookstores here.
Mm-hmm.
That answer your question?
Yeah, no, it totally did. And for people, I'm constantly told that I don't repeat myself enough when I'm on the air, but we are talking about the book As It Is on Earth. We're here with Peter Wheelwright. And I want to thank you for joining me today.
Right. And you can read more about the book. This is where I do my plug, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can read more about the book either at the FOMIT Press website. I think it's just www.fomitpress.com. If I'm wrong about that, somebody's going to FOMITE. You can FOMITE press. You can get it correctly, or you can read the news and events reviews and my heady little blog. I hate to say it, I've become a blogger. Hey, at PeterWheelwright.com.
Peter, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Sarah.
We're going to go for the sake of symmetry. and design. We're going to go back to Fela Kuti.
All right.
he's our backbone today.
Rock steady.
Fela's birthday. And if anybody's listening and heard just a portion of that or wants to listen back, we'll have this conversation archived on wgxc.org/archives in a couple hours. Bye, Peter.
Bye, Sarah.